his memoir, which he has called Drama, John Lithgow says he never meant to become an actor. He wanted to be a painter. But he had been born into a theatrical family. His father, Arthur, was an actor, director, producer, and a great lover of Shakespeare. And John spent his childhood backstage and on stage, making his first appearance at the age of 2 in a production of The Emperor's New Clothes in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Since then, Mr. Lithgow has appeared on Broadway, in movies, and on TV. He's won Emmys, Tonys, Golden Globes for roles that have included a space alien in the sitcom Third Rock from the Sun and a serial killer in the Showtime series Dexter. He was on our show in October to discuss his book, and we're re-airing that conversation for you now. I began my conversation with John Lithgow by noting you've said that you were inspired to write this book by the month you spent caring for your father in 2002, which you describe in a really moving preface.
Yeah, actually, there was a sort of intermediate stage toward writing the book, which was devising a solo show that sort of evoked that that month, and that particularly the event of reading a bedtime story to him and my mom from a book that he used to read bedtime stories to us from.
Had he deteriorated to the point where that bedtime story would be more relevant, or were you just doing something to remind him of the wonderful times you'd had in the past?
Mainly, I was simply trying to cheer him up. That was my main task.
Because he was in poor health and lost his will to live at this point.
He was extremely depressed, and this was not a man prone to depression at all. He was a very genial kind of a boisterous man with a huge laugh, and he had just fallen silent. And so I read to him, I showed him this old book, dusty old book that he used to use, and I told him to pick a story, and he picked P.G. Woodhouse's Uncle Fred Flits By.
Oh, that's hilarious.
I immediately recognized the title, but I'd forgotten the story, so I read it to him, discovering as I read what a fantastic piece of humor it was. And sure enough, it did the trick. It made him laugh, and in my perception of it, it brought him back to life.
But both of you had the advantage of reading that story in that you were actors. Many parents will read that story and a lot will be lost on the kid.
Mm-hmm.
Were you aware of the fact that your father had that craft when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I idolized him as an actor. I thought he was a fantastic actor, a much better actor than he may have been. You know, I just kind of worshipped him. Actually, one of the arcs of the book is that kind of classic story of idolatry giving way to skepticism. And
because he had a rather uneven career.
Yeah, and it was not just his failures in the profession. I mean, the profession is brutal, and you can't avoid failures. I just, as a young and kind of impetuous, full of himself youth, once I finally decided to be an actor, I felt that he was old-fashioned.
How much longer did he live?
He lived for another year and a half after that event. He died at 88.
He was one of the first Americans who produced every one of William Shakespeare's plays.
Mm-hmm. The whole canon. He actually ran 4 different Shakespeare festivals all over Ohio when I was growing up, which is why we were such a gypsy wagon of a family.
Now, just when your own career began to take off, when you're in your mid-20s, your father was fired from his position as artistic director of the MacArthur Theater. Mm-hmm. In Princeton, of all places, a job he'd held onto longer than almost any other. Why was he fired?
Whoever knows why. It's like the Terry Francona being fired, you know.
Yeah, but he lost the pennant.
I know. Well, my father had, he'd done a couple of too many disappointing shows, and he'd been artistic director for 10 years. He was in his late 50s at the time. And that was, I was in my late 20s. My career had suddenly taken off with my Broadway debut. I'd won a Tony Award. I was suddenly a hireable actor in New York. At just that very moment, he lost his job, and it was the last really good job he had in the profession.
Well, were you ever able to understand why your father seemed unable to hold on to a job for more than a couple of years? Was it bad luck, or was there more to that? Was he difficult to work with.
Oh, no. He was an angel to work with. He was almost too nice. It's one thing I write about in the book is he lacked the essential son of a bitch chromosome to be a really commanding theater manager. One of my great frustrations with him when I was actually – he hired me. He gave me all my first professional work. And at a certain point, he wanted me to stay on working for his company, and I wanted to go to New York and really test myself in the marketplace. And one of my frustrations was it seemed to me that he settled for too little. He seemed to avoid working with difficult people. And in my experience, some of the best people in entertainment are the most difficult. You just have to deal with it.
My guest is John Lithgow, who's written a memoir called Drama, An Actor's Education. It is published by Harper. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You suggested that you had a similar life to an army brat.
Yeah.
Moving all around. Was that difficult? Because you go to a school, you make friends, and then a couple of years later, you're off to a whole other place.
Yeah. Army brats are always in some sort of base school with a bunch of other army brats. I was always arriving in a classroom of young kids who'd been going to school together, living together, playing together all their lives. And it was very brutal for the sort of middle 4 years of that. I mean, I went to 8 different public schools. But in retrospect, it strikes me as an incredibly vivid childhood and certainly a huge part of my actor's education.
But I just spoke to Julianne Moore about growing up as an army brat, and she said that in talking to actors, she's discovered many of them did not just live in one community throughout all of their childhood. So
yeah.
I guess it's a matter of learning how to being forced to reinvent yourself again and again.
I certainly did, and I got very good at it. I was lucky enough to be in one school for my last 2 years of high school, and it was Princeton High School, a really good high school. And I was so kind of self-assured by that time. It's like a veteran of the wars. I arrived in September of that year, and by January I'd been elected student council president. I was the big man on campus. It gave me a certain feeling of I almost felt suspicious of myself. It came so easily, like I learned how to put on a good show and snow people.
So you don't think that you really deserve the awards? I mean, you got into Harvard, didn't you, on a scholarship?
Yep.
And you did extremely well there, graduated magna cum laude, were chosen to be Phi Beta Kappa. And as you said, you somehow feel that you had just tricked everyone.
You know, it's a funny thing. It is a thread that runs through the book that I was not even aware of as I was writing it. But I do think it's something I share with a lot of actors, a kind of pendulum swing between self-pride and self-doubt. What we do is fooling people. I mean, they want to be fooled, and they love it when we're good at it. But there is a certain self-contempt that is an occupational hazard.
Well, you have to be inauthentic on some level in your life as an actor.
Yeah.
And perhaps you question whether that's the way you are all the time.
Yeah, it's like you're never sure whether – I mean, I like to think of myself – I like to think that I'm a good person. But there's something in me that wonders to what degree am I pretending to be a good person, you know?
To an outsider, it would seem that you're almost predestined to become an actor, but you held on to your dream to become a painter until your sophomore year in college.
Yeah. Yeah, I was a very serious art student. I had the good fortune of some fantastic art training in public schools, of all things, growing up. The Akron Public Schools had the most amazing art programs, for example. And I went to the Art Students League studying figure drawing and watercolors. I was really earnest about it.
Well, you said your favorite painter was Norman Rockwell. Did that change when you went to the Art Students League?
Yeah, that was my favorite painter until my 10th year, 10th or 11th. I mean, I still think he's amazing, but an amazing illustrator. Once I finally got to New York in the early 1960s, New York was a completely different art scene from anything I'd seen before. And it sort of blew my mind and opened my my horizons as a painter. But it all went by the wayside as soon as I got to Harvard. You know, I went to Harvard because I got in. I wanted to go to the best possible school and get the best possible education. But you don't go to Harvard to study painting. You don't go
You go to Yale to study painting.
Well, you can study painting at Yale. Yes, exactly. You don't go to Harvard to study acting either, but there's a huge amount of theater that goes on. And brilliant kids, directors and actors, who are genuinely interested. Not many of them actually go into the theater or any of the arts, but there's a huge amount of activity.
But if I were being asked by a kid, should I become an actor or a painter, I'd say you've chosen two of the professions that are hardest to survive in.
I know, but I had a genuine passion for art growing up. I don't know where it came from, but it kicked in as early as I can remember.
Is it totally gone now?
Do you No, I'm still a hobbyist, but I admire painters too much to actually call myself a painter.
But then you said you finally decided to embrace your destiny and become a professional actor during your sophomore year at Harvard. When you stepped in to fill the lead role in a lavish college production of Gilbert and Sullivan's Utopia Limited. So singing as well.
Well, that was my first time singing on stage. I'd grown up mainly in the Shakespearean vein. But I just had this kind of epiphany experience, absolutely stopping the show in a Gilbert and Sullivan patter song and having the audience applaud. So literally stopping the show. They wouldn't let me begin the next scene. They were applauding and roaring with and cheering.
And you said, I want more of that.
I said, wow, boy. As I say in the book, if you hear enough laughter and applause early on, you're doomed. That's what you will be.
Well, you must have had some moments where the opposite occurred.
You know, I grew up doing Shakespeare in my dad's companies, where you are part of a big ensemble, and the thrill of theater was the thrill of being in that company, always in little roles. It's like stopping the show was never part of the. It was never your great aspiration.
Many Americans still believe that the best actors are the British actors, and you wound up going to London to study. Your father, you say, looked stricken when you told him that you'd applied for and won a Fulbright scholarship.
Yeah. It was an interesting moment in both our lives. We had so misperceived each other. He was disappointed that I'd chosen to become an actor, and I was amazed that he was disappointed.
He wanted you to be a director or a producer.
Well,
if you're going to stay in theater.
He saw me as a producer-director. He felt, if you're going to do it in such a way that you're in charge. The acting business is too fraught with disappointment and rejection and failure. No matter how well you do, you're at other people's behest. He said, in fact, his notion for me was to go to business school, of all things. He confessed to feeling that this was his great lack as a theater manager. He'd never really known how to budget. He was terrible at personnel. He didn't know how to run an institution, although he'd been doing it as long as through my entire childhood. It had been a sort of chaotic process in every case. And he thought, why not go to business school? Well, the idea of going to business school to me was completely insane.
But what did you hope to get out of going to the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Arts? Did you see a future career as a leading man?
I saw my career in American Repertory Theater, basically my father's profession, doing what he did, acting and managing. I had done a huge amount of acting. I was an experienced actor, but I did, to me at that point in my life, I thought that the British Academy training was the best training, and I'd never been to England. So
now you've written 8 books before, but they were all for children.
Mm-hmm.
So when did writing become something that you became interested in?
Well, writing this book, it grew right out of this solo show, Stories by Heart, which in turn grew right out of my experience with my father. I think when you reach my age, I think I was 62, two or so when I began writing the book, you spend a lot, you think an awful lot about your father and your mother. I mean, so many memoirs, men's memoirs and stage plays, they do dwell on their on your father. It's like you think a lot about where you came from. And because I'd had such an intense experience with him toward the end of his life, doing the show, it was very interesting because I'd never written anything for myself to perform from my own experience. This was the very first time. And it was married to the wonderful work of P.G. Woodhouse. You know, it delighted people, the story. But the introduction of the story, many of the things I've just told you about, it really reached people. And they identified with it. And, you know, you just wait for successes to sort of kick you along to the next level.
And, well, you have to find a voice, especially when you're writing for the ear.
Mm-hmm.
Did you keep that voice when you wrote the memoir?
I didn't know what I was doing. I just started writing as if I were talking to a good friend and trying to recapture my memories and the most vivid memories. I didn't quite know where I was going. About halfway through, I discovered that the spine of what I was writing was what I've subtitled the book, An Actor's Education. Every chapter, even though some of them don't involve acting or the stage at all, they impacted me somehow. They sort of developed me as an actor in some way.
My guest is John Lithgow, who's written a memoir called Drama, An Actor's Education. It is published by Harper. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with the conversation I had with John Lithgow this past fall. He was here to discuss his memoir called Drama, An Actor's Education. I started off the second part of our conversation by observing that his book is focused primarily on his childhood and his early career on the stage, even though he went on to have a long list of notable roles during his long and successful career on TV, the movies, and the theater. And I asked John Lithgow, why did you decide to end this memoir where you did?
Well, it's... I didn't think I'd ever get to the other side of the ocean when I set out. I decided I got to find a place to stop this somewhere. And it was a very logical place. 80, 81, that was a real watershed career, watershed year in my career. It was the year I finally went to Los Angeles, finally appeared in some major films. My personal life was completely transformed at that point. It was the beginning of my second marriage. And it was also the end of my young years as an actor, in a sense. And it was certainly... it was the year in which I changed from being a theater actor who sometimes does movies to a movie actor who sometimes does theater.
Now, except for the rare few new British actors, most of them start off in theater.
Mm-hmm.
You went to the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Arts for a year and then applied to have the scholarship renewed so you could stay on for an extra year, which is in 1968. You admit that one of the reasons was you wanted to avoid the draft.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnam War was on.
Yeah, I was prolonging my sort of graduate student exemption, and my bid for conscientious objector status had been rejected, and I was against the war. So I just sort of prolonged my time in London.
Well, it was a great time to be in London, wasn't it?
It was a fantastic time. My first year had been the single year, D group year at Lambda. And that had been my London Academy training intensive. The second year I worked at whatever I could scare up on my Fulbright, basically working as an assistant director at the Royal Shakespeare Company and the Royal Court.
Now, I went to a school in London as well and came back with a very obnoxious accent that was neither American nor British.
Yes.
And quickly unlearned saying words like schedule.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's
tough for an actor, isn't it?
It is. And I deceived myself into thinking that I had not sort of taken on this British accent. You you're not aware of it until you get home.
Well, you're speaking that way to be understood
yes.
by the people you're dealing with otherwise.
But also I was
treating you as a yank.
Yeah, but I was also taking diction lessons and speaking Shakespeare and Shaw and living an English life, watching British theater three times a week. So I came back. Fortunately, I had experience where my British accent was thrashed out of me, acting in a Neil Simon play in Summer Stock for a director who rang a little bell every time I sounded English. I couldn't believe it. He was ringing it every 10 seconds.
Well, while you were in London, you did get a draft notice anyway, yeah. asking you to report to a physical in New Jersey.
Yes. And I did what I could by letter saying, no, I can't do it. I'm here on a Fulbright. I can't show up. But they gave me a draft physical anyway on a Royal Air Force base in outside of London. So I went off to my draft physical and reenacted Alice's Restaurant, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It was a different kind of acting altogether. Every word I said was true, but my demeanor was such that they found me unfit for service.
So you were playing crazy. Did you feel at all guilty that you'd done that?
I felt a little crazy, in fact, but I felt I've always felt a certain sense of shame over it. It was a crazy time. I mean, you and I are roughly the same age, and we lived through that period. Anyone who was there knows exactly what we went through, but it doesn't matter. It does stay with you. And as I write in the book, one of the sources of that shame was that I was using acting for the wrong thing. I was not acting for an audience. I was acting for another person, a U.S. Army Air Force shrink. And it just leaves you feeling that to the degree that acting is an art, I had sort of misused it.
When you did get back to the U.S., no longer draft eligible, you went to work for your father at the MacArthur Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And then struck out on your own to work as an actor in New York City. And you and I have something in common, not just that we both went to England to study. I went to art school, by the way.
Mm.
We both spent time at WBAI. I'm still stuck in radio. How did you escape?
Well, I'm here too, Leonard.
Did you like working in radio? Because
yeah,
some actors have said that what radio forces you to do is use your voice in a way that you might not otherwise when you can rely on your body language.
Yeah. Well, I was doing theatrics on radio. I mean, our great models were The Goon Show and Firesign Theater. And just as I was leaving BAI, for the first time I heard Monty Python on radio. I guess it was just a radio transcript of their TV. But that kind of gonzo, very highly theatrical satire was what we did. And we have so many people in common. My sound engineers, David Rapkin.
Mm-hmm, of course.
And Peasy, Zanger, all those people. It was an amazing time, and it was great fun to write about. That church on East 63rd Street, that deconsecrated church.
Which WBAI lost because Ed Koch claimed that it had to pay taxes on it, even though BAI said it was a nonprofit and didn't have to. They wound up winning the case in court, but by then they'd lost the church. I understand you did a pretty good impression of Richard Nixon. Do
yes.
you still do it? When Frank Langella got the role, did you think, gee, I should have gotten that part?
No. I saw Frank, and I defer to Frank. He was
amazing performance.
It was marvelous, yeah.
But your big break in show business came when you were hired by the Long Wharf Theater Company in New Haven and cast as Kendall, lead character in The Changing Room, and that brought you to Broadway?
Yeah. It was not the lead character. That was a 22-man ensemble show, this incredible play by David Story about a semi-professional rugby team in the north of England. We did it at Long Wharf the year after it premiered in London, and the production got such attention and praise that it was brought lock, stock, and barrel to Broadway, where I never thought I would ever appear.
Could you do your British accent again?
That's probably gone, too. I'd have to brush it up. But it was a deep North Country, like a Leeds, bloody football. You know, that's something that we talked like that. But it was an extraordinary play that had a huge impact. And it opened on my debut on Broadway. It was March 7th, 1973. And on March 25th, I won a Tony Award for it.
Did that make it easier to find work?
Yes.
You could say that, Tony Award winner John Lithgow.
Well, I've never really been out of work since then. And that was on the heels of about two solid years of unemployment in New York.
You've written that Terms of Endearment was hands down the best film you've ever appeared in. It won 5 Academy Awards. And although you didn't win one, you were nominated for Best Supporting Actor. If you don't mind, I'd like to play a little clip from that just because I think it's so funny. It is when you help Deborah Winger with a cashier.
Oh, this will be fun.
Mrs. Horton? I'm Sam Burns from the bank. I turned you down on the second on your house.
Oh, of course. I remember who you are.
Can I help you make up the difference here?
Thanks. I'd appreciate it. I'll pay you back tomorrow.
You're a very rude young woman. I know Douglas from the Rotary, and I can't believe he'd want you treating customers so badly.
I don't think I was treating her badly.
Then you must be from New York.
You were criticizing a supermarket cashier because she was giving Deborah Winger's character such a hard time because she discovered she didn't have all the money that was necessary to pay the bill. Do you have any idea when you were working on Terms of Endearment that it would be such a success at the box office?
You know, it was a crazy experience. I was actually acting in Footloose at the time, or rehearsing for the movie Footloose, and I was recruited to just come to Nebraska for 5 days to do this role. I was replaced another actor at the last minute. And it was like jumping on a runaway train that was completely out of control. It was a crazy atmosphere with some people not talking to each other and squabbling and refusing to come out of their trailers. It was nuts. And I thought, wow, this movie doesn't have a chance. Well, of course, you never know with movies.
Well, I would assume that's true for an awful lot of things that you worked in or anyone else works in. You think this thing is a sure hit and it flops and something else, this doesn't have a chance. And
yeah,
it takes off. It's a
strange unreality. On the inside, you never have a good objective sense of what you're doing. And I'm constantly surprised. In a way, whenever you work on anything, you do what you can to persuade yourself it's great. And that is much more often the case, that it's not as great as you think it is.
Over your career, you've managed to split your time between the theater and television and the movies. Do you enjoy doing each one equally?
I enjoy theater more, but I certainly wouldn't give up movies and TV.
You're probably best known for the odd characters you've played on television, on 30 Rock. Third Rock from the Sun and in Dexter. Mm-hmm. Does that bother you?
No, not in the slightest. I'm pretty much, I'm pleased with everything I've done that anybody knows about. The stuff that I'm not so proud of, nobody's seen it anyway. But theater is, I don't know, it's just like I keep returning to it because it feels like that's the area in which I'm using everything I've got.
And also it's where you began at 2 years old.
And I think what I brought to movies and TV is my theater chops. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I'm an over-the-top actor. I'm big in every way, including physically. It's what makes me unusual in those. But it's because theater is my source material.
Well, a lot of actors have talked about the difficulty of bringing things down when they appear on the screen, either of those screens, because in the theater you can be over the top. You move your hands around a lot. You can throw your body around a lot. When you do that in the movies, you look like you're crazy.
It's all modulation. I mean, when I did the Twilight Zone movie, or that segment of the Twilight Zone movie in the early 80s, I worked for George Miller, the Australian director who just directed The Road Warrior. he was the first film director who told me to do more instead of less. Mm. Nothing was ever enough for him.
He had done Mad Max.
He'd done Mad Max and Road Warrior. And boy, he had me. It was so liberating. And I still think it's one of my best film performances.
I understand you're returning to Broadway in April to play Joseph Alsop in The Columnist, mm-hmm. a new play by David Auburn. And, of course, I'm looking forward to seeing that and having you back on our show. I don't know if you read reviews. A lot of actors say they don't. But in his New York Times review of your book, Charles McGrath said that it recounts in graceful, considered prose a life that, after a few wrong turns, is now happier and more well-adjusted than most. You have to be pleased by that.
Well, I also loved talking to Charles McGrath.
So are we going to have a follow-up to this book?
I don't know. It's when I finished it, I definitely felt, wow, I won't have to do this again.
Going to be writing more children's books?
My editor at Simon & Schuster is waiting.
Uh-huh.
But I still continue to entertain kids, and that's like a fantastic sideline that I kind of can't do without.
John Lithgow, an award-winning actor who starred in stage and film and television and has been a New York Times bestselling author of 8 books for children. His latest book is a memoir called Drama and Actor's Education. It is published by Harper's. Thank you so much for being on our show
Leonard,
today.
Great to talk to you.